I'm like not ambidextrous, except for I can mouse.
So you're going to start.
All right.
That one.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for May 12th, Thursday. As you can see, we have a pretty packed agenda, and unfortunately, we're not necessarily going to go in the order that is on the agenda. We will start with House Bill 3516A, and we have a representative here. I'm going to open up a public hearing, and Beth, if you can provide an overview, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3516A would establish as an outright permitted use the installation and use of solar thermal energy systems on residential and commercial buildings. The provisions of the bill do not apply to federally or locally designated historic buildings, landmarks, or in historic districts, or if located in the, within the boundaries of a locally designated conservation district. You do have a -A6 amendment in your packet. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued.
Okay, thank you, and welcome, Representative. Can you let us know what this bill is about, why we need it,
and
what's the problem it's trying to solve?
Sure, thank you, Madam
thank
Chair,
you.
Members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46. I will be brief. I have my own committee to chair. I'm sure you'll appreciate that with a 30-30 House, co-chairs are reluctant to leave their committees even for a moment. It meant entrusting Representative Gilliam with the gavel. And even though it's just an informational session, I figure anything could happen if Representative Gilliam has the gavel. So I will be brief. Thanks for hearing the bill. House Bill 3516 deals with solar energy, and it really contains two provisions you'll hear more about from some other witnesses. But in brief, last session we established a feed-in tariff program, a pilot program for folks who want to sell the energy they produce off their rooftops to utilities. We want to clarify that folks can do that and not be treated as a commercial site for our purposes of our land use system. We're talking about residential rooftop solar, and there have been some jurisdictions that have looked at that and said, well, wait a second, you're selling power, so that makes you commercial, you're in a residential zone, so we're clarifying that with part of the bill. And we are also attempting to streamline the permitting process for solar energy on rooftops, again in a residential setting, just trying to make sure that there are not unnecessary hoops put in front of homeowners who want to put renewable energy on their roofs. We've had some experiences in Portland where the city has, through its building codes division and through its permitting process, has made life pretty difficult for folks who are merely trying to put a photovoltaic system on their roof. So there's been a long kind of stakeholder process to get to the point of the bill you have before us. It had the support not only of the solar community, but a number of folks in the city of Portland. There was initial angst expressed by the cities and by the city. We think we sort of worked through that and got our local governments to feel okay about the bill. I understand that Senator Olson may have an amendment. I'm supportive of that amendment. I'm encouraging the committee and Senator Olson to work with me and with the cities and counties to make sure that our local government feel comfortable with the amendment as well. But that's the bill in a nutshell. It's a good deal for those who want to avoid some local challenges associated with doing solar on their roofs.
Okay, thank you, Representative. And just to reiterate, I think you said this, but this is limited to residential structures, correct?
Correct. We're talking about residential solar.
Excuse me.
And also, installation use on commercial, because you only talked about residential, so commercial on small commercial. Only,
which, and I'm sorry, I don't have the bill in front of me, and right. It might be good to not, for me not to dig myself into a deeper and deeper hole by allowing that.
Yes,
you understand the bill to.
I will want to get clarification on what small commercial qualifying system or solar thermal energy system, what that would entail. So we will, I'm sure we'll get some clarification when we have Mark and Lisa come up and talk about it, but because I thought, and maybe I just missed, but I thought that I had heard you say only residential, so I just want to make sure for the record.
I have certainly been focused on residential. I mean, we do want to clarify that a residential use of solar is continues to be permissible in a residential neighborhood. That's where some of the land use challenges have come in. They may speak to other issues associated with that.
Okay. Well, we don't want to detain you because I do know that you have concerns about your committee.
Concerns may be overstated.
I should say a little angst. So any quick questions for the representative?
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative.
Okay.
Representative Gilliam has given me about 14 quick questions for you. No, I just want to point out, thank you very much. This is a good bill. The amendment that you mentioned was specifically geared towards building codes and how this would be codified. And the concern was, as a builder, when you get into planes and things like that, if you codify things and put specific words, building inspectors have a tendency to listen and adhere to those specific words. So I wanted to make sure that everything was clear, so that when it goes into the building codes, that they understand that this is what you intend, and try to make it a little less arduous for the homeowners. But this is a good bill. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And I, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I appreciate that effort and intention, and I fully support it. Thank you.
Any other questions for the representative?
Chuck, ask about 10. Keep him here.
He's Thank a quiet you. One, remember?
Take my yes.
Thank you for coming here and explaining this bill, and we will let you know if there's any follow-up. Okay, next up is we're going to have Lisa Nato, Mark Pengilly, and Shara Alexander. If you could all come up, that would be helpful.
Get one more chair.
So we don't define, so small commercial qualifying system is not defined, right?
A qualifying system is defined where the statute is being put.
Okay, yeah. That's what I wanted to make sure.
Six.
Mm-hmm.
Are you looking at two?
Yeah. Just making sure that the small commercial, how this is defined. So she's going to look it up.
It's new.
Yeah. Under notwithstanding definitions. Okay. Hi, whoever wants to go first. We were just talking about the small commercial qualifying system, getting that definition on the record. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Pengilly. I represent several small solar installers. I'm also one of the individuals who experienced difficulties trying to install a solar system on his house, and so I have a personal interest in this bill as well. Representative Cannon did a good job summarizing the bill, and in view of your docket today, I will try to be as brief as possible. To give you some of the particulars, in my case, I live in a zone which has an environmental overlay, so I applied for my permit for my solar panel and applied for a mortgage, and then to my amazement, my application was referred to the Multnomah County Land Use Planning Office for a significant environmental concern. I thought I was doing something good for the environment, but the concern was for the impact on scenic views. My house is not visible from any of the identified viewing areas. It's not visible from anywhere. My panels were mounted flat on the roof. They did not exceed the height of the house, but I was subject to $800 in permit fees and up to a five-month delay while the permit was being processed. Meanwhile, I'm paying principal interest on the mortgage, and in addition to the permitting expense, these systems qualify for a 30% federal tax credit. So instead of being able to take my federal tax credit this spring in 2011, my $14,000 federal tax credit was postponed until the spring of 2012, which did violence to the economics of my system. I was fortunate. I was still able to put in the system, but these additional permitting costs, these financial impacts, can be a bar to some people's ability to put a panel system on their roof. And there was no public benefit served by this. The problem is that when you apply for a building permit, it's referred out much as a structure is, in fact, in exactly the same way. So I was asked to submit photographs, elevation drawings, contour maps, grading maps and so forth. Additional expense. So as Representative Cannon mentioned, this is designed not only to remove those obstacles which serve no public good, but also to make it clear that people can sell electricity back to the grid in all zones. I have had a technological failure today. I tried to submit some documents to you electronically, and that didn't work. So thanks to staff, their copies have been made, and hopefully you have those documents before you. I want to refer to, well, just a moment. Let me clarify one statement that Representative Cannon began to get in trouble for. This bill does apply both to residences and to small commercial buildings. A qualifying system refers to the
definitions right here.
Okay. To the systems under the solar incentive pilot program for the feed-in tariff. And most residential systems are under 10 kilowatts in size, and small commercial qualifying systems can be up to 100 kilowatts in size. So this would apply to small commercial rooftops as well as residential rooftops. After meeting with Senator Olson and hearing his concerns, we have done a little bit more research, and the documents, which I hope you now have mm-hmm. before you, one of them is from a company called Solyndra, which has a new technology that uses round tubes to collect the light rather than flat panels. I do not represent Solyndra. I just did this research the other day to see what the impact might be on new technologies that were coming into the solar world. The specification sheet which you have lists the dimensions on these panels conveniently in metric. I have converted those to inches. The top of the panel is supposed to be 0.36 meters above the roof surface. That works out to 14.17 inches. The bottom of the panel would be 11.81 inches from the surface of the roof. And the language, which is the subject of the A6 amendments, limits that distance to 12 inches. So if the bill were to be passed into law without the A6 amendments, this new technology would not have the ability to be installed without a land use review. I mention that just as an example of the questionable wisdom of putting these specific requirements in the statute as opposed to in a building code, because when these new technologies come along, what is our ability to respond to them? The other thing is the key issue, I think, that we have discussed with the Oregon League of Cities and the City of Portland is where this particular information about solar installation should be contained. My view on this is that we're better to have this in the statewide solar code, a small excerpt of which you have in front of you. And in that excerpt from the solar code, if you look on the right-hand column down in the bottom, paragraph 4, height, says that the maximum module height above the roof shall be 18 inches. This, the language that's currently in the Dash 6 amendments is 12 inches. I would be more comfortable if we did not put these requirements in the statute, but left them to the statewide code and to the local building codes. The point here is that since we want to avoid these costs and delay to the solar systems, these things could be dealt with by the building departments rather than being kicked out for a separate, an additional, and more expensive, time-consuming view by the land use planning offices. With that, I will let Lisa Nato respond to
Thank
any
you,
questions you have.
Lisa, do you want to add a few comments before you answer questions?
Yes, please. Thank you. Chair Jane Fielder,
Mark,
member of the committee, Environment and Natural Resources Committee. I'm former State Representative Lisa Nato and also former County Commissioner, and as a former public servant, would like to thank you for your service today and for hearing the 3516 Engross version of the bill that we have before us. I'm doing this pro bono and happy to do it because I enjoy working with you and think this is a really important public policy to try to move solar energy as far along as we can. I worked with Mark and many others last session on House Bill 3039 to get the pilot program for feed-in tariff. And one of the goals of that bill is to bring down the costs to generate a larger market so that the cost for installing solar panels can pencil out for the consumer and be more financially beneficial so that more people install solar panels on their rooftops. To that end, this bill addresses that issue to try to get land use decisions to be separate and get those restrictions and requirement to be unnecessary and to install your solar installations. This would be, they still should be subject to safety reviews and under the building codes provisions and under the solar, statewide solar requirements. The cheaper and more predictable it is for a landowner or building owner to install their solar rooftops, the more people will do it. There's no question about that. The House Committee heard testimony about historic properties and conservation districts, and I want to commend Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Cannon, as he conducted a very deliberative and thoughtful process which resulted in the engrossed version. As Mark pointed out, the technology in this field is rapidly changing, and therefore I support the A6 amendments. Again, the building codes are the appropriate place to regulate height and those kind of requirements, and local building codes can address those as well as the statewide solar code. Thank you very much for your consideration of this bill today, and I appreciate your service.
Okay. Well, why don't we hear from Shara? You're with Multnomah County, and then we'll take questions, and then we have some folks from the League of Oregon Cities and the City of Portland to testify as well.
Thank you. I live in Multnomah County, but I'm not with Multnomah County.
Got it.
I think it just said
you're,
what county.
Yeah,
I live in a conservation district, and I'm just
Shara,
a resident.
Can you say your name for the...
So, Shara Alexander.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. This is my first time testifying anywhere on anything, and I just think it's a great opportunity, and my kids are really proud of me for coming down here. So.
Just make sure they don't make you answer all the questions.
Yeah.
I tried that.
Accurately, I don't know. We started this process as a family being very excited to join in the solar revolution that seemed to be going on in Portland. The city was promoting an expansion of their Solarize program. They moved from Solarize Southeast to Solarize Northeast. And in January of 2010, we joined along, and we're excited about some of those tax credits and moving forward with more progressive kind of form of energy. We joined with it was Solar City was the contractor that was hired for Solarize Northeast, and we didn't foresee any problems. I spoke to them specifically about being in a conservation district. I was aware of that, but because there were other solar panels visible in our neighborhood and in other conservation districts, and there was no language specific to solar panels, and because it was a city program, I didn't anticipate there being any problems, but I was wrong. Our permit was denied, and that started a process of discussion among other conservation district neighbors who had also been denied to find out how we had missed this, how this was a blind spot for us and what we could do to change it. So we met with the city with Adam's staff and among others, and this is going way back now, but it didn't make any progress, and we were told that RICAP 5, this discussion had already happened, and that we had missed our chance to put that change in the code language. So it was fairly frustrating. So I was happy to hear that the state was, that the legislature was considering this bill, and I'm in full support of it. I would ask that it would be great for those of us in conservation districts if we had equal access to solar. I would ask that you find a way to strike that language that refers to conservation districts, because it's not, I don't think it's enough if you've got a neighborhood where, depending on the orientation of your house, one house is able to have solar and another house isn't, it's just confusing for people. And it also, to be honest, people are in support of solar, and they are in support of visible solar. I mean, I have gone to the Boise Neighborhood Association, the Elliott Neighborhood Association, and we have letters of support from these conservation districts that say nobody sees a problem with seeing solar panels in these districts. They're not the same as historic districts. They don't have the same kind of intact fabric. I live on a street that is that has a lot of development from the 70s. It has there's razor wire, you know, like half a block away. It's fairly urban and impacted. It's very much unlike Irvington or Ladd's Addition, which are very intact and so that's a really different circumstance. But I would ask that you, if you get a chance to read the letters from conservation district neighbors, you'll see that there people just don't have a problem with solar, and it's almost universal. I've yet to meet someone who in our conservation districts who is opposed to visible solar. In fact, they're in support of it. And I just appreciate you giving me a chance to testify, and thanks for all your hard work on this bill.
Thank you very much for being here today. We appreciate it, and it's interesting to hear your perspective, obviously as a homeowner who's dealt with this personally, so that's very helpful. Questions for any of these panel members?
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Pengilly, the amendment that I authored, or that I was assisted in authoring, we eliminated the within 12 inches of the surface roof part of it. I didn't know if you were aware of that or not.
I was not.
So the product that you were talking about, that Solyndra, would be totally acceptable under with the Dash 6 amendment.
Senator Olson.
Because I know these don't come out very fast.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you very much. And thank you for being here. We're going to hear from Chris Fick and Dan Eisenbeiss. And would anybody else like to come up and testify on this bill? We are just having a public hearing today, just so you know. Okay. All right, gentlemen, whoever wants to go first.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Dan Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 3516. Would like to begin by saying that the City of Portland is strongly supportive of installation of solar systems both in Portland and throughout the state. We've been leaders in that regard with many of our programs, participate in the Solarize Oregon program, also have the Clean Energy Works Portland program, which has been expanding to a statewide effort. We are not amongst those jurisdictions that have asserted that solar systems under a feed-in tariff scenario would not be allowable in a residential zone, for instance, and very much see value in that portion of the bill, and in fact on the House side offered language or the suggestion to make sure that portion of the bill also covered solar thermal systems for solar hot water heaters. We believe that this bill is indeed the product of some careful compromise to balance streamlined permitting for solar systems with their unobtrusive solar systems, those that are flush mounted with roof lines outside of areas that have historic value. That's why there's exemptions for historic districts, historic landmarks, and at least the front-facing roof lines within conservation districts, which the easiest way to think of conservation districts is essentially as locally designated versions of historic districts. They're areas that have historic value. In fact, three of the districts that have been designated in the City of Portland have gone on to be designated as federally recognized historic districts in Lair Hill, Ladd's Addition, and Irvington. We would ask you not to adopt the Dash A6 amendments. Although well-intentioned, we believe that the amendments would broaden the preemption on local land use authority to allow systems to be installed that would be create a new plane on the roof, for instance, askew from the roof line. Initially, we had asked that this preemption be restricted to systems that are flush mounted. In the work group, we were told that flush mounted seemed confusing, and so that's why language ended up there that said parallel to the roof line and within the 12-inch distance. To the degree that the amendments delete the parallel language, we feel like it could lead to systems that have very substantial visual impacts. That said, I think we'd be more than happy to engage in discussions about refinements to the bill. So with all of that, I'll conclude my comments and welcome any questions. Thank
Great.
You.
Thanks, Dan.
Chris? Good afternoon, Chair Dinkfelder, other members of the committee. Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. As Representative Cannon in the previous panel mentioned, this bill before you is part of a carefully crafted compromise. It's very rare, as you all know, that the League support any sort of preemption. So our goals, as Dan mentioned, was to make these systems, if we were going to allow them, to be streamlined and outrightly permitted, to be as unobtrusive as possible. That compromise was carefully crafted with the proponents of the bill. We arrived at the 12-inch threshold and parallel to the roof. As Dan just mentioned, after doing a little bit of research, we inquired with several different energy panel installing companies in the Portland metro area and found that 9 inches was roughly the limit for most of these systems. So we gave 12 inches to provide for some cushion. Certainly, technology is evolving. As Mark pointed out, there are systems which may or may not be installed anywhere in the city of Oregon that may require more clearance. This bill does not ban those installations. It just requires that they perhaps undergo an additional review. According to Live Light Energy, who we spoke to, 99% of the installations that they conducted over the past several years would qualify under this 12-inch threshold. And in terms of flat surfaces, which is where these tubes would likely be installed, we don't see that as being particularly onerous or subject to, we have no evidence that that would create any sort of a barrier as city law is written now. So we see this, as I mentioned to Senator Wilson this morning, as legislative creep, where we're just continuing to look for a problem that may or may not exist. We think this is a compromise, as written, that goes a long ways towards addressing the concerns that the proponents brought forward to the legislature.
Okay. All right. Thanks, gentlemen. Questions? Senator Wilson, I have a feeling you have a question.
Yeah, I do. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your coming in. One of the concerns as a builder, and that's my background, when you say a parallel plane to a roof and an energy system comes in, such as the one we just heard about that needed to have 14.17 inches, it's a new technology, go through another process, in other words, another set of permits, another more delays, angst for the owner, whether it can be passed or can't be passed. What's wrong with a little more flexibility? I mean, everybody wants this progressive energy source. What's wrong with a little flexibility to make it where consumers, particularly in those zones that are conservation zones, can take advantage and not have the city dictate this parallel, for example, parallel plane? If a 412 pitch roof comes in, does that give maximum solar absorption to the panel, or if it's on a 12-12 pitch roof, there's a little bit different there, and the way the plane lays. The reason I thought that we should get rid of that parallel line is that sometimes those panels, you know, the house might not be oriented perfectly north-south or east-west, and those panels might have to be canted slightly. So under your proposal, there would be no cant. If it wasn't parallel, we would lose efficiency in the panels. How would you explain that?
As Mr. Fick noted, that as the bill is constructed, systems that do not meet the conditions that are laid out in the bill, it's not that they would be disallowed, it's that they would simply be subject to the regular local land use authority. I'm not familiar personally with the Solyndra systems, but talking with Mr. Pengilly prior to the hearing, he mentioned that those are systems designed for flat roofs. At least in the city of Portland's code, we actually allow for racked systems on flat roofs, subject to a certain setback from the roof line with a parapet on the edge of the roof to reduce the visual impact. So I'm not aware of any instances in which there have been issues where somebody has wanted to put in a racked system on a flat roof, for instance, that's encountered problems. But as I noted earlier in my testimony, removing the parallel language would mean that, for instance, on side or rear-facing roofs within conservation districts, districts that have some historic value, the bill, if amended that way, would allow systems on racks that are tilted up from the roof line, creating a more substantial visual impact, and that was one of the considerations that we had wanted to address in the bill. So, that's
okay. From a builder standpoint, we get a big code book that we build by. This will be codified. This will be put into the building code book. Now, if a building inspector comes out and sees that a panel is not parallel with the roof, he could, in fact, turn down that source, that energy source, because it wasn't in per code. If it was to perhaps extend beyond 12 inches above the roof line, he could, or 12 inches above the roof itself, he could, in fact, deny the use of that system until those items were changed. So why can't we open this up a little bit and put it into the building code where it needs to be for use, codified, so that when the building inspector comes out, he can make that decision that, yes, this meets the criteria that we want.
So here's what I think I'm going to do, unless there are other questions for these witnesses. I think what we're going to do is have a little mini work group here. As I mentioned, we're not moving the bill today, and we're on early next week. We'll be getting the representative and you and the proponents of the bill, and Senator Olson has already volunteered to help out with this.
I don't remember that.
So because we have a lot of people here to testify on other bills, I have a feeling we could be discussing this all afternoon. So I think with time of the essence, and that we have a short amount of time left in this committee, that's what the chair would like to do. So with that, we're going to go ahead, unless anybody else would like to testify on this bill. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3516, and I will, if the proponents of the bill can make sure and follow up with the committee staff, we'll put together time on Monday to meet.
Would you ask Ms. Alexander if she'd like to be involved?
Yes, and we will follow up with Ms. Alexander if you'd like to be involved via phone as well, would be fine.
Would
so
you?
If you can make sure and leave your contact information with the committee
Would you
staff.
Like to be involved?
I would love to.
Okay.
Okay, so we have closed the public hearing on that. We have several representatives in the audience that are waiting anxiously for their bills. So first up, we will do House Bill 3538A. I think Representative Harker is still here. And just for folks to know, we'll do HCR 3 after that. And then we will do House Bill 3571 and then House Bill 2827. So with that, Representative, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3538A. However, Beth is going to provide an overview first. Thank you for your patience.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3538A would direct the Energy Facility Siting Council to adopt rules establishing global warming potential of greenhouse gases. It further defines greenhouse gases as including carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. There is no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement in your packet.
Okay. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Ding.
We won't ask you a question about solar right now.
Okay, although I am in the process of having it installed on my garage right now.
Excellent.
Right now.
Excellent.
Oh,
okay.
Already given the potential conflict.
Yeah, I was going to say when you vote, don't forget to do that.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. How do you get things done with just one chair down here?
We like it that way. We're efficient.
Okay, so
some like it that way.
I should clarify that. The chair prefers it that way, but.
It is true that we're talking about greenhouse gases here, but this is such a narrowly drafted bill that we believe it is palatable to all, regardless of one's view of the role of humans in climate change. So in 1997, this body adopted cutting-edge legislation that created a carbon dioxide emission standard for new fossil fuel-based electricity generating facilities built in the state. In fact, Oregon was the first state to adopt such a forward-looking statute. The statute was adopted with good intentions, but it has fallen behind the times. The standard requires that new facilities which can't meet the CO2 emissions requirements are required to offset their CO2 emissions, and this part's the sticky wicket, but they can only do it with offset projects that sequester or eliminate carbon dioxide. Since 97, our understanding of greenhouse gases has changed dramatically, and we now recognize that there are additional gases which contribute to climate change. These gases include methane, nitrous oxide, and sulfur hexafluoride. We also know that some of these other gases have a climate change potential that is more potent than carbon dioxide, which is the standard against which they're compared. For example, one molecule of methane is about 23 times more potent as a climate change agent than is CO2, and a single molecule of nitrous oxide is nearly 300 times more potent in that regard, not to mention 10,000 times funnier, as the dental technicians will tell you. House Bill 3538 would update how Oregon law recognizes that update Oregon law to recognize that funding offset projects which reduce methane or nitrous oxide emissions into the atmosphere is every bit as valuable as reducing CO2 emissions, if not more so. This change will bring Oregon more into line with accepted scientific standards on offsets, and in addition, House Bill 3538 would allow the Climate Trust to invest in Oregon-based projects that will benefit Oregonians through increased job creation. For example, in rural areas, there are projects currently prevented from participation which will become eligible for offsets. These include a landfill gas capture project down in the Roseburg area and a dairy-based methane digester near Tillamook. The projects will provide additional revenue sources for dairy farmers while simultaneously improving water quality, and reducing noxious odors. The need for an update has been agreed upon unanimously by the Oregon Advisory Committee on Carbon Dioxide Equivalent Offsets, a multi-party stakeholder group appointed by the Oregon Department of Energy, and under these new provisions, there will be greater efficiency in the offset investments. Under House Bill 3538, no utility that's building a new natural gas-fired electricity generating unit will have to pay anything additional for meeting the CO2 emission standard, and there is no additional cost to the state for making this change. So I want to thank you for having the hearing over here. I will try to answer any questions that you might have, and I know that there are other people here to testify.
We have quite a few people signed up to testify, but any questions for the representative before we let him go back to his duties?
Back to work.
Okay. Thank you, Representative, for coming here today and sharing your perspective.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Okay, I'm going to call up folks, and I am going to just remind folks I have about 5 more bills up, so I'm going to encourage people, one, if you have written testimony, please hand that to our committee staff, and please do not read your testimony, and we are going to ask people to be brief and focus on key points. Otherwise, the chair will notify you, and we will move along. We have Bob Shiprack, Brendan McCarthy, and Gary Bauer. Hey, gentlemen. Clock is ticking. Thanks. Whoever would like to go first? Bob, you want to go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Shiprack, and today I'm representing the Energy Facility Siting Council. I've been a member there for almost 8 years. We are actually the people that asked for this bill to be drafted and introduced. I want to just briefly explain who we are, because it'll give you an idea of kind of the philosophy. The chair is a farmer from Hermiston. Lori is a crop insurance salesman from Pendleton. Barry is the community development officer for the city of Boardman. Paul is a fourth-generation attorney from Central Oregon, Trey is community development for Klamath County. And myself, we don't get up every morning and think about climate change and polar ice caps and all that. What we have in front of us is a bill that the siting council is charged by the legislature for overseeing the climate trust, these dollars that are collected from the ratepayers. What we want to do, and we're asking for the legislature to help us, by passing this bill, it will do about three things, in my opinion, and I'm representing the council. It will create Oregon jobs. Just one digester, methane digester on a farm, one was recently done in Lane County, so I have the statistics, looked at them this morning, created 5,500 hours of work for construction people and local contractors. Right now, those projects are prohibited because we can't mitigate methane. Same goes with the nitrous oxides. The second thing it does is it will allow us to spend these dollars in Oregon. We've spent some of this money outside of North America. The council does not approve of that. We want Oregon jobs. We want Oregon residents to reap these benefits in a good fashion. Thirdly, and then I'll close, is that it would allow us to better spend ratepayer money on the intent of what the dollars and what the legislature intended back in 1997. It simply expands the list of gases to methane and nitrous oxide. That's what it does. I'll try and answer any questions, but that's just to the point. And we hope that the legislature will correct what they did in 97, and it's a good bill for it's a good government bill, in my opinion. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Bob. I guess we'll hear from the other gentleman, and then we'll take questions.
That's fine.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Brendan McCarthy, representing Portland General Electric. Portland General Electric's an investor-owned utility. We serve 822,000 customers with electricity in the Northern Willamette Valley. We serve about 4,000 square miles. And under this climate offset standard, we are one of the few entities that has paid under the monetary path. When we sited our Port Westward plant, we and our ratepayers paid $5.7 million to the Climate Trust as a means of meeting this standard. We intend to site two gas-fired power plants in the near future, one a baseload facility and another a variable facility. We'll pay for both of those facilities. So we're talking about some significant investment coming up soon in the state. It's important to us that when we make that investment and when our ratepayers, more importantly, make that investment, it's invested efficiently and does what they're paying for it to do. We have been working hand-in-hand with the Climate Trust on this bill. I served on the task force that looked at expanding this last fall. To us, it makes sense. It is a simple update, as Bob said. We have changed our understanding of climate science since 97. The increased flexibility will ensure that the Climate Trust can put those dollars to use immediately. They have told us, and we believe them. We actually have a PGE employee who sits on their board. It has been difficult for them to find high quality, and that's important, high quality CO2 only offsets in the amount that they need. And if we can help them find high quality offsets that accomplish the purpose of this statute as it was adopted in 97 by moving to methane and nitrous oxide, we think we should do that. And I'll close with that and let Gary say some more.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. Gary Bauer, representing Northwest Natural. We're a natural gas distribution company. I won't repeat everything. I'll just say that, as stated, it provides flexibility in how the money is spent, allows money to remain in Oregon, and it would be spent on Oregon businesses and jobs. Thank you.
You get the award for the briefest. Okay, Senator Thompson.
I have a question for Bob. I got a question for you. Thanks for coming today. Will this bill require the money to be spent in Oregon, or can you still spend it overseas or wherever you want?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, this is an issue that I have dealt with many, many years, and for the attorneys on the committee, you have a preemption issue with the Constitution of saying we're going to spend the money in Oregon. It's the Commerce Clause to the Constitution. I went to the Attorney General's office, tried to get around it, and they said, just for your benefit, if you try and do this, we will ask the governor to veto the bill. And the order that was signed was by this guy named Kulongowski, so I think he probably would do it. He ordered that when he was on the Supreme Court. So we cannot do that, but that is the clear intent of what we're trying to accomplish here. Right now, we can't.
Follow up? So it can't be in the bill, but can you do your darndest to spend it in Oregon?
That's already been discussed. Absolutely, you can clearly encourage that, and then that is exactly what the Climate Trust is doing now. Passage of this bill will allow them to go ahead and fund 8 methane projects, mainly agricultural, all within the city, the state of Oregon. Absolutely.
Yeah. My understanding is this will expand the types of projects that are allowable, and right now we are limited in the types of projects because there just aren't that many projects in Oregon.
That's correct.
Am I understanding that right? Okay.
If I could add, Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, the bill originally, as envisioned, we would have expanded the standard to include all 6 major greenhouse gases, and when it was over in the House, people came forward and wanted to limit the where the investments were. What we did in part was to cut out the sulfur hexafluoride and the perfluorocarbons and others that have been issues overseas with the quality of those offsets.
Right.
So constraining it to the methane and the nitrous oxide gases, we've got gases that are mostly agricultural and agricultural related. So that will help.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Great. Thank you, gentlemen. We have a couple more people like to testify. David Ford, Matt Delaney, and John Ledger. Again, if you have written testimony, if you can please hand it in, I'm going to ask you to summarize. Okay. Why don't you go ahead first and state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is David Ford. I'm a professional forester and also the president and CEO of LNC Carbon. I see my senators here as well. Senator Haas, nice to see you. I'm here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association and its 2 subsidiaries, Woodlands Carbon and LNC Carbon. And I also am a forest landowner myself. My land's in Yanville County. We're here today, representing Oregon Small Woodlands and its subsidiaries in opposition to the bill as it's currently drafted. This bill is about 14 years old, as was indicated in your previous panel, and we feel like lots has changed in the last 14 years, including Oregon Small Woodlands, who would think they would be involved in the carbon market. That's happened just in the last 3 years. Lots of things are going on in the marketplace today, and so we would really like to see this bill more comprehensively reviewed and updated. And we're not opposed to expanding the definition of greenhouse gases to include methane and nitrous oxide. However, we would like to see some limitations placed on the carbon offset generation, where those carbon offsets are generated from. And we'd also like to see the definition of a qualified organization updated and simplified. If you've taken a look at that language, we think there's some limitations there that we don't support. So we have 3 proposed changes that we'd like to see in the bill. One, we'd like to require that a majority of the offsets originate here in Oregon. To your point, Senator Thompson, in your question before. And why is that the case? Because Oregon has some of the greatest sequestration assets in the world here with our forests and our agricultural lands. And we believe that we have significant opportunities here, including those family forest landowners that I work with that are quite interested in participating in that market. The current statute places no limitation. We recognize that I've had conversation with legislative counsel as well about is there an interstate commerce issue. Although I heard the comments from the other panel, we're not convinced that there is. We know that the state of Colorado, for example, has a similar limitation in place. So it would be, I think, worthwhile looking into that to see if they can do it, why can't we do it here in Oregon? It's really clear to us that if we're producing the offsets here in Oregon, if we're producing the emissions here in Oregon through our activities and Oregon ratepayers are paying for it, then we ought to try to focus on requiring that we do as many projects as we can here within the state. We'd also like to see the bill, so point two is encourage that forest and agriculture offsets are given a preference. Again, because we have such great assets here in the state, and we think that forestry and agricultural focused projects will help encourage sustainable land management and reward landowners here in Oregon that are doing sustainable management. And that not only benefits the landowners, but that benefits all Oregonians. And the final point is that we'd like to see the qualified organization definition that's in the law updated and simplified in the statute, in part because we want to see competition, an opportunity for folks to be able to compete and create jobs here in Oregon and use the Oregon ratepayer dollars to the best value as possible. Today, the only organization that's operating under the qualified organization definition is the Climate Trust. When you look at that language, it's quite clear. We actually had a work session on the House side that included some of the folks that were on the panel previously in the Climate Trust that was hosted by co-chairs Gilliam and Cannon. And I think there was pretty broad consensus that that definition is antiquated, outdated, and it really should be looked at. So recognizing that's going to take a little bit of work. We would support some sort of a work group that would take a look at that and maybe report back to this committee and the House committee early next year with some recommendations. How do we streamline that, really with the objective of simplifying and creating opportunities for more competition in the marketplace related to those that are involved in delivering offsets to meet the current statute. So those are my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And Matt Delaney is here with me. He's also works for LNC Carbon, and he's here to help answer the questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Did you want to add anything, Matt, or just
for
questions? Okay. Why don't we hear from Mr. Ledger, and then we'll see if there's any questions. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. I'll be very brief because you've heard quite a bit about the bill. I just wanted to mention this committee, for some of you, will recall this has been the site of some fairly spirited conversations about greenhouse gas bills, and we're pleased to say this is not one of them. We see this as a good pro-business bill. We see it as a good pro-environment bill. We think it's well done, and we would ask for your support. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, John. Appreciate that. Any questions? Senator Pinonski? No. He's pointing to. Notice I looked this way first because I was anticipating.
Mr. Ford, I have one question for you,
yeah.
And it deals with your point two and point three, where you want to encourage that forest and agriculture get preference, but then you want to open up qualified organizations for more competition. Doesn't that kind of diametrically oppose each other? You want preference to get the greenhouse. The offsets, but you want somebody else to compete at a better level?
So, David Ford, Vice Chair Olson, there are actually two very different things. One is providing a preference for where those offsets come from. They come from forestry-based projects like extending rotations of trees to sequester more carbon versus a qualified organization, which is an organization that will select and verify projects to ensure that they meet the standards that are being set. So they're very different kinds of things. Right now, the Climate Trust is the only one that's actually involved. The money from this bill, so the ratepayers through the utilities are actually required under this current legislation to pay for offsets based on the amount of CO2 emissions that they're generating when they put new plants online. For example, there are two new plants that are going to be coming online here sometime in the near future that will generate somewhere on $12 million, we understand. That money then would go to the Climate Trust. They're the only ones that are doing that today, and we'd like to actually create an opportunity for other organizations. And I might say that LNC Carbon, we're not here for self-interest in that. We are not interested in playing that role, but we do know that there are others are, and we'd be willing to support others to participate in bringing projects forward that will meet these offset requirements.
I'd just like to clarify my point. I don't mind the competition, and you're right. We need to have more people that can spread that money out. My only concern is if we're going to have competition, I don't know that I would like to encourage that forest and ag get first shot at all this money. I'd like to see competition out there also in that venue. There should be some other areas, businesses that could compete equitably. And if we encourage or write into the bill that you get preference, then it kind of takes away the competition on that side. That's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, and just a clarification, David Ford. The reason, obviously, we have such great assets here in Oregon, and we have great forestry assets and great ag assets, and they're two areas where we can generate a lot of carbon offsets. And so we had to recognize the assets that are naturally occurring in Oregon as compared to, say, New Jersey or Massachusetts, which don't have those kind of assets. So we had to focus on where we have our strengths, and we think our strengths here in Oregon are forestry and agriculture, and those are good places to be able to do offsets.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Anybody else like to testify in this bill before we close the public hearing?
We're down to three.
Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3538A. We will open up a public hearing on HCR 3. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome. So you got to sit through photovoltaics and greenhouse gases, so I'm sure...
Something easy.
Yeah.
I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm here to introduce the discussion on House Concurrent Resolution 3. Senator Olson and Senator Thompson have threatened to quiz me on soil science. So I ask as a matter of personal privilege if I can introduce this stuff and then later surround myself with some experts to help me out. So
lifelines.
Madam Chair, absolutely not.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, that.
Madam Chair, this is a dirty business, and he's got to come up.
Well, there's going to be a lot of soil jokes.
All right. Well, I've failed tests before. I can fail this one as well. You'll hear from, this bill was introduced to me by my friend Richard Page, who you'll hear from in a bit, who pointed out that the Smithsonian Institution was creating a national touring exhibit about the different soils of the state, and that the soil scientists in Oregon, you'll hear more about that from some of the top soil scientists in the state yet, selected Jury Soil as the unofficial state soil as a part of that exhibit, which is now touring the country. And they'll explain to you why that choice was made. This bill brings into coherence the unofficial state soil and would make Jury Soil the state soil to go with many other state icons that we have across a whole variety of topics. So with that, I'll just say I'm pleased that you're hearing this bill. I hope that you'll listen carefully to the folks that are following me. I'll hang around if you want to ask me questions when we're done, and I hope you will hear it well and then move it on.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. And I should say hearing this bill again. We're having a little bit of deja vu, but appreciate you being here. And I know we're going to hear from some experts, so we'll get them up here to make sure that they can answer any questions.
And I can postpone the
You should have moved when you could.
I was going to say you're too slow for the draw. Senator Thompson.
Representative, thank you for coming. I just have a quick question. I live in Hood River. We've got good sandy loam soils up there. And the soil underneath, I have soils up there that are underneath the trees of the state fruit. So what makes you think this soil is better than good sandy loam from Hood River?
Well, let me say, I voted for pears to be the state fruit, in spite of the fact
that's not
that
fair.
It's in
Thank you.
Could you grow it and enjoy?
All right, thank you. We have Scott Burns, Jay Noller, and Brian Raby. Is that how I say it?
It's right.
Yep, great. Thank you, gentlemen. Oh, and Brian, why don't you wait, and then you can come up with the next
kids.
Generation. So that's great. Welcome back, Scott.
And thank you very much, Senator Dingfelder. Scott Burns, professor of geology, Portland State University, and past president of the Oregon Soil Science Society. And everybody who is following is supporting this bill. Just the background on this, back in 1990, the Soil Science Society of America asked all of the state soil science societies to come up with a state soil. And so we did, and Brian Raby, who is following me, was one of the members of that original committee. They had three different things. First of all, they said it has to have large extent in the state. Number two, it has to have a great many different types of crops being grown on it. And number three, it has to have a special story. So out of all of the hundreds of soil series found in the state, the jury came right to the top. Number one, over 300,000 acres in the state. Number two, many different things being grown. Christmas trees, orchards, tree farms, berries, filberts, grass, wheat, and grapes. The very first winery and vineyard in the state in modern times was on this. The third story is the interesting thing, and that is uniting the east side and the west side in the state, which we always try to do. But it's very difficult with soils because the climate has a lot to do with the development of it. But the Jory is developed primarily on the Columbia River basalt, and which is extensive in the state. Where did it all come from? The east side. Where did it weather? On the west side. And so this is a way of uniting both sides of the state in this. And so for us, scientifically coming up with this, we said this is the perfect one for us. This is a resource. It's very important for our agricultural community, but also it's very important environmentally. It is a major filter that we have got for cleaning up our water. It has been mentioned the Diggett soil, the show that was at the Smithsonian for the last couple of years, now is a traveling show. If you go to that, they have all of the 50 different soils from all the states. There is a monolith of the Jory soil that is here representing the state of Oregon. Out of those 50 state soils, and then three from the territories, over 22 of them have been officially ratified by the states. And so we are stepping forward to you today and asking that you will take this, support it, vote on it, send it to the floor. And so after me, we have Gene Noller, who is chair of the Soil Science Department at Oregon State. He also passed Oregon Soil Science Society President Brian Raby and his two kids, and then Dick Page, a member of the Jory family. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Professor Jay Noller, Oregon State University leader of the Soil Science Faculty at Oregon State Corvallis and the Cascade Campus. And I thank you, Madam Chair and Senators, for this opportunity. I represent the interests of the educational community, especially those who train our future teachers, our lay teachers who work for the soil and water conservation districts around the state, for our future farmers of America, teachers at our high schools, and as well as the many volunteer educators who provide that outreach and education that tell us about soil as an important resource for the state. We see that the Jory, whereas it really represents one small fraction of this great state, is emblematic of many things, and they provide the key touchstone in order to grab the attention of learners, be they school children or adults. And it's from the Jory that we can gain their attention and show that the state, especially the state government, recognizes that this soil is important, and more than that, the soil itself is important. And from that, the conversation can move to understanding soil, be it in Hood River or any other Canby, any other district, any other part of the state. I'm blessed in that I have a great number of very learned soil scientists who have traveled throughout the state and also represent a tradition of those who have studied soils throughout the state that provide for the rich food and fiber resources. Really, what makes money in this state is that ability to turn the natural into something that we can use in commerce and in trade. And I think Jory is emblematic of that. We can see that the Jory has its story as been told and will be told today. And it's more that it is an educational resource. And so I'm asking, and on behalf of my colleagues, that we are given this important touchstone for that. In this day and age, we see that the Jory soil is like many other soils in our upland forested landscapes that the EPA and many others, scientists around the world, continue to come to our area and look at the Jory and Jory-like soils and say, this is going to be one of the important natural mitigating factors for the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere. And so we also see it as not only a pledge for what it has been in the past, but also for the future hope. And finally, I would say that I've painted many portraits. I'm an artist as well, of soils around this great state. I think that it's it is the best place to learn about soils, and it is also the best place to demonstrate to people around the world that the importance of this foundational resource. And on behalf of my colleagues, I thank you all. I can take questions.
Great, thank you. Thank you both. Questions for any of these, either of these gentlemen? Senator Olson.
Of course. Thank you, professors. How many types of soils do we have in our state?
We have more than 3,200 soil map units in the state.
Is this the majority soil we have?
It is not the majority in terms of acreage.
Number four.
Is it number four?
Yeah.
So why didn't we pick the...
Follow up.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to follow up?
and the committee addressed this initially, and some of the ones that were up above that didn't have quite the agricultural commitment for the soil. So we wanted to have something that had a lot of crops growing on it. And some of them are in dry, very dry, arid areas that were not in that. So we tried to have a balance of those.
Follow up.
We were paid to harass you guys before.
I love it.
No, this is good. And if I was to grade your presentation, I would give you an A.
Thank you.
So you did good.
Thank you, Professor Olson. I mean, Senator Olson.
I was going to say that's a promotion from being a senator. But thank you very much for your testimony here today. Thank you. So we have Brian, and you have some young guests with you.
You want to sit here? You want to put second? Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Madam Chair Duke.
Hey, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. I'm still a rookie, but I was here about 5 weeks ago, so I feel like a veteran now.
And just a reminder to state your name for
yes,
the record.
Yes, that was next. My name is Brian Raby, and I'm a certified professional soil scientist from down in Albany. And as Scott mentioned, I was a member of the original State Soil Committee. The earliest correspondence I found was July of 1991. So with some of the earlier pre-committee stuff, yeah, it's been over 20 years since we started this process. I have with me my daughter, Kaylin, who's 15, my son, Brogan, who's 11. So as you can tell, both of them were born long after this process began. But they have been witness to parts of it along the way, and they get to listen to me and talk about soils quite often over time. But I would like to pause for just a moment and let them each say a couple of things briefly, and then I'll continue briefly and move along.
Great. Well, welcome here today, and thanks for coming. And just if you can state your name for the record, I noticed I think you're wearing T-shirts that are the color
yes.
of Jory soil. Is that
yeah.
is that right? Okay.
I'm Kaylin Raby. Our skin is one of our most important organs. Without it, we would not be able to live. Soil is the earth's skin. It filters out pollution as water moves through it. I showed this to my classmates as a part of a science fair project when I was in the third grade, and I won a first place ribbon. Learning about soils is important so that we can manage our resources properly. Please vote to support Jory as our state soil. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm Brogan Raby, and one of my science fair projects looked at how plants grew in different soils, and sand dried out too fast, and clay stayed wet for a long time and was hard for the roots to grow in. Topsoil was just right, and different soils are good for different things. I like to play around in soil a lot. And
I bet your mom doesn't like that, but anyway.
I helped my dad make these shirts with Jory Soil, so please make Jory our official state soil.
Thank you.
And these T-shirts, unfortunately, have worn with age. It's pretty difficult to take a nice bright red soil, and that is, to touch a moment on one of the questions that was asked earlier, among the various selection criteria, it was a consensus process that we had an even number of 10 people, so there was no tiebreaker. It was a full consensus process to reach the candidate soil back then. And one of the things that was looked at was distinctive features. And some of the other candidate soils, if you and I were to walk out on the landscape, we couldn't really tell them apart from others because on the surface they look the same. But Jory is very distinguishable. It's very easy to see as you drive up I-5 by the Enchanted Forest and Willamette Valley Vineyards. There's nice cut banks there of red Jory soil. One of the other nice things about the complex manner in which redistricting has occurred over the years is that I would guess almost every one of your districts has at least a little bit of Jory soil in it. I know Senator Olson's does for sure, just again by the district boundaries and the region of the state that it's in. But again, I believe all of yours have probably at least a little bit in it. And again, our T-shirts aren't quite as distinctively bright red-orange as the Jory soil is because, again, they've faded with time. My wife about killed me when I put them in the dryer the first time. But having a state soil, one of the things that's important, from our perspective, it's been the state soil for 20 years. And having been recognized by the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Smithsonian Institution, you know, that's all important. But it's the state recognition that is that last little piece where then it becomes included in the Blue Book, which is something where a lot of primary and secondary teachers turn for, you know, educational materials to teach kids, our kids, about Oregon and Oregon's resources and Oregon's history. And so that's where it really sort of rounds out the full official recognition. I think most of the things that I have in my written testimony, a lot of folks have covered, and I know in the interest of time you have a lot of stuff to cover today. Trying to think of anything that I didn't touch on that others have. But again, it's in the written testimony, and I'll, in the interest of being brief, I thank you for your attention, and I would welcome any questions and follow-up that you may have.
Great. Thank you very much, and thank you for bringing Brogan and Kalen here today. They did great.
Yes, this was a nice legislative field trip for them.
Excellent.
To learn about the process.
Any
thank you.
Any questions? The senator's going to go easy on you. So.
I'm disappointed, sir.
Thank you. And last, Richard Page. And anybody else would like to come up and testify in HCR3? Welcome, Mr. Page.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Just before I
can you state your name
here,
for the record?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
My name is Richard Page. Senator Green, or excuse me, Representative Greenlick handed me a prop to put here, which is a jar of Jory soil, and you can see, as Mr. Ray talked about, the red color of it. I'm here to testify today in favor of House Concurrent Resolution 3, which names Jory Soil as Oregon's official state soil and upgrades its status which is now an unofficial state soil. First, let me give you my standing in this matter. I was born here in Salem in 1926, and I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian. My great-great-grandfather was James Jory, who came to Oregon in 1847 across the plains with his family. The Jory family emigrated from Cornwall in 1832. They stayed there a while looking for better land all the time. In 1836, they came to the States down the outside of the East Coast, up the Mississippi River in a steam wheeler, settled first in Missouri, didn't like the slavery problem, went across the river to Illinois and lived there for a decade. The mosquitoes and the malaria got to them in the waterlands there, and I know they're having floods in the Mississippi right now, probably the same problems. They came overland to Oregon in 1847 with four sons and two daughters. They arrived in Oregon Christmas Day in Oregon City, 1847. That was the year before. The year before Oregon became a territory. The next spring, they ventured down the Willamette Valley, just south of Salem, to Rosedale, out here on Liberty Road, and settled in those rolling hills that reminded Father Jory of the hills of Cornwall. The father and four of the sons took up donation land claims in that area under the Donation Land Claim Act of 1850. And shortly after that, they had about 2,500 contiguous acres of land in their holdings. Today, that area still maintains a lot of remnants and history of the Jory family there. Jory Hill, Jory Park, Jory Creek, Jory Hill Road, and the Jory Cemetery, which is still in existence, and the first person interred in there was one of their daughters in 1852. Jory soil was first identified on a 737-high-foot basalt promontory in the Rosedale District, just south of Salem, in this Jory land, which is, for those of you who know directions, is in the Willamette Meridian Township, 8W, Range 3 West.
So, Mr. Page, we are short on time. We have your written testimony. If you could just wrap up, because we still have a couple more bills, and we would like to make sure that we move on this bill.
Thank you. I think the rest of this information I have in the rest of the testimony has been pretty well cared for by Professor Burns and some of the others. It would be something to do this for the state, and it would be the soil has millions of years of history, and it really would be the namesake of a pioneer blue collar family. I would urge you to pass HCR 3, designating Jory soil as Oregon state soil. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for coming here today. And we have, actually, Senator Brzozinski and I have ridden on Jory Road, which is a very, very challenging, hilly route. And we observed the soils as we've gone by. Senator House.
Very much want to thank Dick Page for coming. He's from my area, and I have gotten to know him over the years as someone with a certain gravitas when it comes to history and common sense. And so I'm doing what he tells me.
We can certainly use more common sense in this building, so we appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else that would like to testify on HCR 3? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on HCR 3. We'll open up a work session on HCR 3, and I will accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I enjoy the opportunity to move HCR 3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I do think that Senator Olson has made a motion to move HCR 3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is that the right motion for?
Be adopted.
Oh, be adopted. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Haas? Aye.
Senator Kozlowski?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Senator Dingfelder?
Aye. That the motion is adopted, and Senator Olson, would you
absolutely
like to carry this bill?
Oh, Mr. Page, it's wonderful history.
I think you might have to borrow a T-shirt for that. But
yeah, where do I get? I've got to have one on the floor.
So with that, we will close the work session on HCR 3. Thank you. We will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3571A. Beth.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3571A would specify that the owner of a qualifying facility is the owner of the renewable energy certificates created pursuant to a system established under ORS 469.130 for generation during the term of the contract that was in effect prior to November 20, 2005. There is no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued.
Okay, and thank you, Beth. And well, you are efficient because we already have the folks that would like to testify up here. So why don't you go ahead, Gary?
Madam Chair, Dingfelder, members of the committee, thank you very much for letting me testify here today. We also owe a special thanks to Representative Clem, who couldn't be here, but who introduced this on our behalf, and Vice Chair Olson, who co-sponsored the bill, and Senator Thompson, who co-sponsored the bill. We're pleased that this bill is not...
Can you state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. My name is Gary Marcus, and I'm here to represent not only my own project, the Falls Creek Project, but also a coalition of projects. And Ed Pugh and Brent Stevenson will talk about their projects when they come up.
And we can't... there's feedback from the mics.
Too close.
That can
oh, okay.
You don't have...
I'm a little hoarse.
okay, we can hear you just fine.
Okay, so fortunately this bill is not quite as complicated as the soil bill. And we're sensitive to your time. We've been practicing. I think we have it down to about 12 minutes and 41 seconds. So I think along those lines, I want to give you a little history because the history kind of explains why we have the bill. And fortunately, what happened was that California has opened up its borders to accept renewable energy credits from out of state and from Oregon. And so we went down there to apply to sell our credits there, and they said, well, you have to prove you own these credits. Now, it just so happens if you wrote your contract with the power company after November of 2005, then you do own the credits. That was a PUC ruling. But it's unclear. The law is silent on who owns the credits before November 2005. So this bill is basically... a long-form birth certificate of the credits that were before at that time. That was actually a joke. All right, so let's take a look at this. This presentation actually is divided into three parts, and the first part explains what the bill is. The second explains who it benefits, and the third is who supports the bill. And if I'm too close to the mic, let me know. So the current law, I'm going to summarize on this. There are really three parts to this, as I mentioned. Any project that's written after November of 2009, the PUC ruled it owns the credit. If it's before that time, the PUC did not really want to, felt it wasn't in their jurisdiction, and felt it was in the legislature's jurisdiction to determine that. That's why the bill is here, to clarify the law. There's a third part. And the third part is in the information that I gave you, and it's the letter written by Representative Clem. And this letter was actually contributed to by the Public Utility Commission, Pacific Corps, and Representative Clem's office. And it talks about any possible ambiguity not stated in the bill, so that if there is any questions in the future, that it can be looked at through legislative history. Now, who benefits from this project? So at $10 a rec, which we think is the going price now in California, close to it, Oregon will receive about $2.5 million a year from California. And most of this money will go to maintaining and creating jobs in rural Oregon. And in addition to encouraging renewable energy,
The money from California will support irrigation and water district projects serving over, it's actually much more than that, 13,000 customers and over 70,000 acres of land in agricultural production. In addition, Biomass 1, which burns wood waste in southern Oregon, also benefits not only itself but its surrounding mills. And who loses? As far as we know, nobody. There are no viable markets for these RECs in Oregon. It costs Oregon nothing and brings money into the state. So this is the Biomass 1 plant. It recovers about 350,000 tons a year of wood waste, and that wood waste is going here instead of in landfills. It's not taking up landfill room, and it's also not being burned in as forest slash, so it prevents the pollution from open burning. The plant has 65 jobs and an additional 80 to 100 jobs in fuel procurement. This is a Central Oregon Irrigation District project. This is an incredible project. It has 7,000 customers, 44,000 acres in farmland. It will produce 22,000 megawatts a year, which means about $220,000 going to the district, and it's LIHI certified pending. LIHI means Low Impact Hydropower Institute, and it's the gold standard of hydropower projects. So these projects strive to be LIHI certified. This is the Deschutes Valley Water District, and Ed Pugh is the manager of that. He's going to be discussing it.
Chairman Dingfelder and committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm Ed Pugh, the manager of Deschutes Valley Water District. Our water district, it's a drinking water district. We serve the cities of Madras, Metolius, and Culver, and the surrounding areas. It's a huge district in area, so it's an expensive challenge to deliver safe drinking water to that big of an area. And our source, Opal Springs, you may have heard of it, is at the bottom of an 850-foot deep Crooked River Canyon. The power bills in the summertime are close to $40,000 a month. So if this energy credit cash from California comes to fruition, Deschutes Valley Water District will really feel the difference. Our 15,000 people, it says 5,000 customers, it's 5,000 water meters, so it's closer to 15,000 people. It'll make a difference keeping our water rates low to the customer, not just the resident customers, but business customers. And we haven't taxed Central Hydro Plant went in. This will help us continue to avoid taxation. And we have some big ticket infrastructure projects planned in the next 10 years. This revenue would help us finance those without having to do the bonding costs and all that. So I would encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. This is my project. This is the Falls Creek project. This project has the highest head in continental United States. That means that the water falls a greater distance than any other plant in continental U.S., over half a mile. And because of that, we use very little water. And because we use very little water, it's mostly done by pressure, we have almost no impact at all on the fisheries, on the riparian resource. And we won the Oregon Governor's Energy Award in 1986. We were the first project in Oregon and the fourth project in the country to be low-impact certified. We're very much a part of our community, and we give tours to schools every year and emphasize renewable energy production and also environmental issues. This is the Galesville Dam project. This is typical of a kind of project that wasn't built for hydro. It was built primarily for flood control. It's owned by Douglas County, but they also have ancillary uses. They have over 200 customers who are irrigators, over 2,000 acres, and they do flood control, recreation. Over 60,000 coho salmon are released at the base of the dam for fisheries enhancement. And this project is also going to benefit. Brent Stevens here from the Sandy Hand Water Control District.
Madam Chair, committee members, For the record, my name is Brent Stevenson, manager of the Santiam Water Control District.
I was going to say, that does look like you.
Just a few days ago.
Yes, it was raining. We remember that well.
Our district, water control district, serves about 17,000 acres of irrigation from Staten on into the Salem area. We also have some flood control duties and drainage functions that we perform, and then a small function of generating hydropower. Passage of this bill would help us to keep our increasing costs in control. It will help us to keep the cost to our patrons lower, and I would urge your support.
Right, thank you.
So I think there's a similar...
Hoping you can wrap up, Gary.
All right.
Yep.
These are all similar.
Wait, go back one, because that's in
yes,
Senator
Thompson's
district.
Yes, that is in Senator Thompson's district. And there's actually something unique about this.
Yeah.
See, this is something that they created. This is a fish passage, and this allows fish to go back upstream and downstream, and it cleans the water. And because of this, they've actually formed a nonprofit corporation that sells this fish stream, this sells that passage. And you can see it occurs. This is Middle Fork, also in Senator Thompson's service territory. They're installing one of these. This is typical of the kind of cooperation that all of us share. We share our technology, and because of this, it allows us to be LEHE certified, and this is where these REC credits go. They go for this kind of mitigation, for this kind of cleanup of the environment, for enhancing fisheries. Who supports it? The Oregon Public Utility Commission supports it. Pacific Corps supports it. Environmental group Renewable Northwest Projects, of course, all of us support it. It was unanimously passed in the House Energy Committee and unanimously passed in the House on the floor, so uncontroversial that it was placed on the consent calendar. So in summary, what the bill does, it clarifies ownership of RECs, who benefits $2.5 million a year, mostly going to creating jobs in rural farming and mill communities. Who supports it? All of the stakeholders, utilities, the PUC, environmental communities. Before this hearing, I thought no one opposed it. We haven't heard of any opposition, but I saw someone had signed up in opposition here. So if you have any questions, and by the way, if they do have opposition, we're ready to respond if necessary or appropriate.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank
questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you
did
very
a great
much.
Job. Obviously, you answered everyone's questions. Excellent presentation, and I'm going to ask if you can send us a PowerPoint for our record also. We have it?
I've done that.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll make sure it gets out to our members.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I have the only other person I've signed up is John Charles. Anybody else like to testify on House Bill 3571A? Okay, John, you're up. And I know you'll be brief.
Mm-hmm.
You're efficient.
Always, Madam Chair. For the record, John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute. I'm not really opposed to the bill per se. Actually, I meant to sign up as neutral. I understand the logic of the PowerPoint. I understand why it seems like this is a win-win. I mean, I'd just like to back up and clarify a few things for people to address a broader issue that is inherent with the REC market. You're sort of going further down a road towards a bubble that has been created through regulation and is going to burst one of these days. And that a REC is a tradable security that is not backed by any asset. A REC represents the so-called environmental attributes of 1 megawatt of certain politically correct power sources. The actual electricity is sold as a separate commodity. And so the person who buys the REC sends money, and what they get is a certificate telling them that they bought some of these unquantifiable, intangible environmental attributes, and they don't even get a T-shirt out of it. They just get a certificate. Well, in a voluntary market, I wouldn't care about that. People are entitled to spend money any way they want, but this is all driven by RPS mandates. And so you're creating a price bubble, a subprime carbon market that is eventually going to leave a lot of people rather angry. The RPS guarantees the market, and in an extreme case where a subcategory of these solar RECs in New Jersey, driven by circumstances in New Jersey, the RECs as of last November were selling up to $660 per REC last year, which was roughly 10 times the value of the actual electricity from the solar facilities. So when the, quote, environmental amenities of something, which don't really exist, are worth 10 times the electricity, that's sort of the classic example of a bubble that's all being created by government regulation, and bubbles eventually burst. So the problem is especially true not for the projects these folks talked about, because these were all biomass or hydro projects that actually are base load projects, and those are good projects. But for intermittent projects, wind and solar, the problem is particularly severe because all of those are sort of power sources on training wheels, and they have to be backed up by actual adult sources that run 24/7, and either they're backed up by Columbia River hydropower, so there's no net gain there, or in the future they will be backed up by natural gas facilities, which means that that backup running 24/7 is going to increase the carbon footprint of the region to the REC market. And so I think this whole problem of this fake commodity called renewable energy credits or certificates that go by different names is eventually going to blow up. It's predictable. It's caused by regulation. And I suggest that there is a solution, and it could either be in this bill or some other bill, and that is to disallow RECs for compliance with RPS for intermittent sources only, wind, solar, because there are no environmental attributes of those to sell. Those are actually negative because of the backup that's required 24/7. That doesn't really affect these. So in that sense, I don't really care about this bill. But at some point, the legislature, which is creating this subprime carbon market, needs to do some more due diligence and begin to address it. Otherwise, a lot of people are going to wind up spending a lot of money with nothing but a certificate that isn't worth anything. Thank you.
Any questions for John? Here's your chance. No. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
For coming forward with those insights. Anybody else like to testify on this bill? Going once, going twice. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3571A. And as soon as we get a committee staff back, we will go for a work session. Okay, go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3571A and take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3571A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves House Bill 3571A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Pass?
Aye.
Senator Brzozowski?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Before I put the gavel down, I will declare a potential conflict of interest because I do work with the Low Impact Hydropower Institute, so I wanted to make sure and get that on the record as a private consultant. We need a carrier, Senator Przonski. Do you want to volunteer, Senator Johnson,
sure.
Since Farmers is involved?
Sure.
Okay.
If that's all right.
I'm absolutely. We like volunteers. I just thought... Since I almost assigned Drury Soils to him, I thought...
You should have.
Yes.
You should have.
Okay. With that, Senator Thompson will be carrying the bill. Thank you, Senator. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3571A. We have one more public hearing and one more work session. So we will be hopefully out of here shortly. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2827. We have a summary from our... Trustee committee staff, and then Paul Romaine is the only person signed up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2827 would permit between October 1 of any year and February 28th of the following year the sale of biodiesel containing additives to prevent congealing or gelling.
Okay. Mr. Romaine, you want to remind for the committee members that weren't here last time, if you could let them know what the problem is and what the issue you're trying to solve. Obviously, our committee worked on this, but for the folks who weren't here last session, I think it would be important for them to understand what the issue is.
Will do. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent here the Oregon Petroleum Association. I learned a lesson today. Never show up at a committee hearing without a state representative in tow. Otherwise,
there you go.
Yeah, I haven't been around the building very long, so I didn't really remember that. But it was very interesting. The soil was fascinating, actually. This bill, basically, we adopted a biofuels requirement with diesel, biodiesel, 2% biodiesel. It's now gone to 5% biodiesel. The problem with that, what we ran into a couple years ago after we adopted this, was we had a scenario where the diesel, because of the bio component and because we couldn't add additives or anything, diesel number one to it, it has a cloud point or a vapor, forget what it's called, it gels basically at a higher temperature than regular diesel. In the wintertime, we normally add additives or some kind of diesel number one to diesel number two to make it work better in cold temperatures. Because of the bio requirement, if we added anything, it dropped it below the 2% requirement or below the 5% requirement now. What this bill does is simply remove the last year, thanks to this committee and thanks to Representative Cannon in the House, we basically put together a group and we came up with a one-year solution, which was allow us to do some additive adding to see if we could get through the winter months in eastern Oregon, and it worked very well. What this bill does is simply remove the sunset on that bill. We wanted to make sure we had a solution. It makes the biodiesel work. Otherwise, you will get into a situation where in very cold temperatures you will have gelling that you really don't want. It's a very simple bill. There's been absolutely no opposition, and we would commend its passage, please.
Okay, thank you, Paul. And also, Beth, you were going to say...
Oh, I just wanted to note that there's a letter for the record from Representative Wisnant as well.
Couldn't be here, but he submitted a letter in support.
Yes.
Any questions for Mr. Romaine?
I was going to say, if he had shown the letter, he might have got up here sooner.
Yeah. There you go. I'm surprised it's taking you that long to figure that out.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, I went to his office to try and get him.
I know you had plenty of time to do that, so I appreciate your patience. I do, since I was involved in the work group last session on this issue, I do appreciate the fact that we are taking the sunset off and making sure that we are not going to have any problems in the future. I appreciate the work of the petroleum industry to help resolve this.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. It's actually much more expensive for us to put additives in. Additives and diesel number one are much more expensive than diesel number two. So believe me, if we didn't have to do it to make it work, we wouldn't do it. We would keep the diesel at 2% or 5%.
Senator Olson?
Yes, I just have one question for my edification. Can we make this effective March 1? Can we backdate this bill? It's supposed to be effective March 1, 2011.
Well, I'm not sure
It said it would become effective. I just was wondering if that's...
You okay. Want to tell us how you came up with the date, and does this date work? I think it's because we only need it during the colder...
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the Legislative Council came up with that language. That's when the old language basically sunsets. It basically just moves it back to that date.
Oh,
we don't need to, and we will not be blending until the fall for the winter.
Oh, I was just trying to find out if we could do a law...
It's a trigger date.
It's a trigger date.
Back to date.
Okay.
Question.
It works fine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But there will be no blending until basically the fall.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions before we let Mr. Romaine loose? Okay. With that, anybody else like to testify on this bill? This is House Bill 2827. Okay. We will go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2827. I think we're about to open up a work session as soon as we get our committee staff and a member back.
Go ahead. We can go slow.
Yeah.
I'll take notes.
We're going to open up the work session on House Bill 2827, and I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2827 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2827 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Senator Brzozinski?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Senator
Dingfelder? Aye. That the motion carries. Any volunteers for this bill? Okay. Senator Brzozinski?
Sure, why not? Put the hay.
Great.
Get the gel out.
Get the gel out. Yeah. Very good. I think that'll be a good floor speech.
I've already started.
With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2827. We have one more work session, which is House Bill 2175A. Beth, if you can remind us about the bill, and I think we do have an amendment in front of us.
We do. Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's an A5 amendment in front of you. This is the bill that would permit an officer to issue a written notification to someone who attracts wildlife that are specified in the bill. The A5 amendment would add just coyotes to the list of potentially habituated wildlife and also add forestry operations to the list of activities to which the bill does not apply. There's a minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued. There's no revenue impact.
Okay. We are in a work session, so I will accept a motion.
Ready for me?
No.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2175A-5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah, well, first we have to adopt the
A5.
We have to
adopt the amendment. I thought we were done with that. Madam Chair, I move we adopt the amendment to 2175.
So it's a -A5.
-A5.
Okay. So Senator Olson moves that we adopt the -A5 amendments into House Bill 2175.
Dated
5/3/2011. Any discussion on that? So this is for coyotes and also for the forestry industry who had testified in support of the bill with the amendment. Okay, seeing none, or any objections? Seeing none, the A5 amendments are adopted. Take another motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2175 as amended to the House floor or to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We'll actually send it to the Senate. But
yeah, we'll send it to the
okay.
Senate.
Okay. Senator Olson moves House Bill 2175 as amended with the -A5s to the floor, Senate floor, with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I know it is late in the day. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Hess, would you be so kind to carry this bill to the floor?
Happy to.
Okay, and with that, we'll close the work session to House Bill 2175A, and I think that is, are we done with our business for today, Beth?
You
are
not going to do the one bill.
Yes, we are going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2336A because we're waiting for some paperwork. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then also we will carry over the possible work sessions. I think we're going to repost a new agenda for Tuesday, so please check that. With no other business, I think we are adjourned. Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, you can keep it. I thought he was keeping it.